This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. That is always good to be back. Unfortunately, it is like 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, and I had to get you in traffic, which, let me tell you.
It's not big white.
We do not have enough patrons to justify that drive, just in terms of my mental sanity.
So, I mean, talking about the Jews, apparently the president...
Talking about the Jews?
Yeah, the president went to you people.
Yes, he went to us people.
And he said, don't worry, we're not going to expropriate your land this time.
Well, he didn't really say that. He's doing these rounds where he comes and he tells different groupings that even though what we say every day and all the time and what we actually legislate in Parliament is that we're going to expropriate land without compensation, even though we say that, we vote with a confirmed racist and anti-Semite in Parliament. We're very happy to be partnered with him. You mustn't worry. That's his big word. You mustn't worry.
Right.
And to the Jews specifically, even though we're going to tell the Israelis to bugger off from our country and we're probably going to pull our embassy out of Israel, don't worry. Don't worry. We really do love Israel. We just love Palestine more. And don't worry. Importantly, don't worry. And any Jew who listens to that and doesn't hear echoes of the Polish rabbis telling the community, don't worry, the Nazis mean you no harm, is an absolute moron. So that's my opinion on that.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the ANC means harm on everyone, not just the Jews.
So oh, sure.
It's not just about you people. So this victimhood culture must end now.
Yeah, well, listen, we're the Canaries, so best you be worried.
I thought those were the Indians.
What?
In Africa, it's the Indians, not the Jews.
Really?
In Europe, it's the Jews.
Because there haven't been many Jews, but South Africa's got a decent-sized community. Anyway, let's talk about other minorities that the government likes to persecute.
Well, which one? There's got a few.
Well, we've got Ernst in studio.
It's Ernst.
I'm a white person, I'm not Afrikaans.
I'll never forget. I'll never forget Ernst going to a show somewhere and someone moaning that white people can't pronounce black names. And said, what do you think, Ernst? Like, that's not my name. Welcome, Ernst.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back on the show. My second time. It's great to speak to you.
It's just a good time. I mean, this is the most magnanimous moment of your life. I mean, Parliament's, you know, it's just... It's a bit, you know, empty these days, devoid of any ideas and interesting things. So, I mean, this is your moment to shine, really, if you think about it, in this very studio.
Well, thank you very much. I agree with you. I think whatever I say will be responded to with more factual accuracy.
Don't you dare call me a straw man.
Yeah, can I tell you something funny about what happened after that hearing? Because a lot of people said they watched the live stream and they saw there were people walking up to me afterwards and they asked me what they said. And what happened was there was a gentleman from the ANC who didn't say anything during the presentation and he came up to me afterwards and he just stood in front of me. I was still sitting at the desk and he said to me, "You're a racist." And I said to him, "Why are you saying this?" And then he said, he repeated, he said, "You're a racist." And he pointed his finger in my face. And I said to him, "Please point out to me what is it that I said that was racist." And then he said, "You called me a straw man." And then I explained to him, "No, I didn't call you a straw man. I said that you were committing a straw man argument." And he looked at me and he said, "What's that?" And I explained to him what a straw man argument is. And then he frowned a bit and then he said to me, "So you're saying my argument is wrong?" I said, "Yes, with due respect, I think so." "And you think your argument is right?" And I said, "Yes, I think so." And then he said, "You see, that's racist." And he turned around and walked away.
Yeah, your tax money, everyone. That guy gets 2 million rand a year to make those kinds of comments in Parliament.
Money well spent. Who needs a circus?
Well, who needs a circus indeed? We've had our fair share. And it's not only the ANC, because let's be honest, if you go to the zoo and a lion roars, you go, "Oh, it's a lion and it roars. That's not strange at all." But the DA, for some reason, decided to lose their minds when you went to Parliament. I think
should we set the scene first?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yes. I think we need to sort of explain what happened for those who haven't seen it.
So, Anas, for the two people who don't know you, who are you and what does AfriForum do? Let's start there.
Well, I'm Deputy CEO at AfriForum, which is, if you read News 24, you would think it's an alt-right group. If you read our founding documents and if you read our, anything we write and say, you will say that it's a civil rights organization with a particular focus on the protection of minority rights. And, of course, we are in many ways built on what is known as classical liberal principles. So we stand for property rights and freedom of speech, property rights and freedom of speech and so forth. And so, and as a result, obviously, we are very strongly against expropriation without compensation. And we've had this whole campaign against expropriation without compensation since the beginning of the year, during which we, among other things, went to the U.S. We spoke to a lot of people there, had an interview with Tucker Carlson on Fox News. And thereafter, I think there were a lot of things that played a role. But more recently, as we know, Donald Trump tweeted about the two things that we went to the U.S. to campaign against, which is expropriation without compensation and farm murders. And I think many people immediately concluded that it was as a result of our campaign there, I think, which is maybe debatable. And
even if it is the result of your campaign, that's a fucking good campaign.
Yeah, it's an act of treason. If you depends on who you listen to. Anyway, so long story short, so we've been involved with this whole campaign against expropriation without compensation. We submitted a few hundred thousand written submissions to Parliament, and we've attended, I think, 32 of the 34 public consultation meetings, spoke there as well. And this, well, in terms of where we are now, the last thing we did was to make oral presentations to Parliament.
Right. So, and I mean, for the record, most of your members, you don't ask for race on the membership forms, but one can presume many of them are Afrikaners, and you represent your members' interests in whatever you do. I mean, it's a very simple, it's a simple concept.
Yes, and we don't shy away from the fact that we do have a focus on the Afrikaner community, but it's not... Anyone can join the organization, but so we sometimes refer to ourselves as an inclusive Afrikaner, inclusive Afrikaner organization.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you're not BLF that says if any whites, you know, if you're white, you can't join us, or Jacob Zuma's new party that said the same thing, except they include Indians, you're not able to join them. So, I mean, you're not racist like that. Yeah. You just have Afrikaner interests. What are, if I may ask, Anas, because I struggle with the term minority rights. I only think they are individual rights myself. What is it about Afrikaner so-called rights, in quotation marks, that are under threat in this country, or that you think are under threat?
Yeah, well, so the question of minority rights sounds simple, but the more you look into it, the more complicated it gets, and it's something that I'm personally very interested in. I'm doing my PhD on that at the moment, in theory, because I haven't done anything since the beginning of this year, for obvious reasons. But part of the thing with minority rights is there's a notion, especially in South Africa and especially by the ANC, that Afrikaners, as an example, and the Jewish community as well, are not really a minority group, or they aren't deserving of particular minority rights protection because they are wealthier on average than the majority. But if you read the documents and research by the United Nations, particularly the Human Rights Council and the Special Rapporteur on Minority Rights, they would say that if history is any indication, that it is precisely those minority groups who are on average wealthier than the majority who are the biggest targets, who are vilified and targeted most frequently, and who are most deserving of some form of rights.
And the 20th century is replete with examples of this.
Yes.
The Kulaks in Russia, the Jews in Germany,
Tutsis in Rwanda,
the middle class farmers in Mao's China,
Armenians,
the Muslims in Myanmar now, Rohingyas.
Yeah. So to make it practical, the question is how then do you protect minority rights? And I think the most important thing to do is to protect the rights of institutions. In other words, if any community should be able to, for example, start a school and make sure that have some degree of control over the language policy of that school, for example, without government intervention. So schools is one example, tertiary institutions, community institutions. And then, of course, there's the whole issue about government legislation that discriminates against minority communities, such as BEE and affirmative action, which are all ways in which discrimination against minorities occur.
Cool. So for those of you who aren't aware, that gives you some idea of what AfriForum is. And really, there's so much misinformation out there. I don't think any other organization has really been demonized quite as much.
Why call it misinformation when it's actually called fake news?
Sure. Fake news, misinformation, whatever you want to call it. And it's going on. Today, even I saw there was an article written which again repeated the lie that you guys have pushed white genocide as an argument or as a campaign when you've never said that as an organization. You've never pushed that. You've very much pushed farm murders. There is a difference between that and white genocide. Yeah. And so there's a lot of misinformation about your organization. But let's talk about this trip that went to the US, because that seems to me to be the time when people sort of took notice and started worrying. I don't know if it was that we can keep our secrets in South Africa, you know, and no one will really notice, but these guys, if they go to America and they get a little bit of traction, this could be a problem. Some people seem to realize that the minute you got on the plane.
Yeah.
And I think you took a selfie or something with Kali and put it on Twitter.
Yeah, at Heathrow, yeah.
Yeah, and I forget which sort of, guilt-ridden white had to respond to this, whether it was Max or whether it was Adrian or who it was. But one of them, Peter Bruce, one of them got very upset about this, and really there were rumblings of, look at these troublemakers going to the U.S. Now, if you didn't have a point, and if you had nothing valuable to say, well, I don't know why there would be any concern. Yeah. So obviously they know there's something to let out of the bag, so to speak.
They should have been glad that if we went there for some campaign that's illegitimate, they should have been glad that we just went there to waste money, that we would have been able to use something else.
Absolutely. If you've got nothing relevant to say and nothing of value that's not underpinned by any facts, then they should laugh at you. They should point and laugh and go, look at these idiots spending their money going all the way to the United States to do what?
That's what I do for Cyril Ramaphosa's economic envoy. They going around the world trying to get investments for South Africa. The only problem is they're spending my money doing it. Fuck it.
So, but they shouldn't have really been concerned. And then equally so, you ended up, I think you did quite a bit there. You mentioned the Fox News appearance. Mm. I mean, this is the other thing I find funny, because everyone goes, well, Fox News is a joke and Fox News has no relevance and Fox News isn't really news and all those things. Well, if all those things are 100% correct, then if someone goes on there, it should be no different to someone going on Saturday Night Live. It shouldn't make a difference.
Yeah.
But you went there. You did meet up with Tucker Carlson. There was an interview with that. You managed to meet up with some state officials, I think, as well. What happened in that regard?
Yeah. Let me just a quick note before I answer that. I think something that's important to mention is you spoke about the white genocide thing. And yes, we have never said that. So people who accuse us of pushing a white genocide narrative have found a screenshot from Facebook that they say, here's evidence you guys have been pushing white genocide. So maybe it's a good idea for the listeners who have seen that, just to give the context. So in 2013, someone in AfriForum's marketing department saw this petition that some other organization was pushing. It was against farm murders, but the heading was Stop White Genocide. And so what happened was, that petition was shared on AfriForum's Facebook page. And after seeing that, we took it down because we don't support the white genocide narrative. But so it was there for a short while. It was taken down, but it was there long enough for someone to take a screenshot. And for that to be published as evidence that AfriForum is claiming that there's white genocide, although we have repeatedly said that this is a problem, but it's not white genocide. And the fact that it's not genocide doesn't mean that it's not a problem. But to get to the question about why we went there, and maybe this links to the approach in Parliament as well, is our campaign against expropriation without compensation is based on a particular strategy. And it's ironically enough something we learned from the ANC. And that's in terms of how you approach political negotiations in the broad sense of the word. So we're not a political party. I'm using it in the broad sense. And that is that the outcome of political negotiations is not determined by what is discussed around the negotiations table. That's the difference between commercial and political negotiations. The outcome is determined by what's happening outside of the boardroom. And the ANC likes to talk about the balance of forces, and they should influence the balance of forces, and they should be guided by the balance of forces. So we believe that we can have a much bigger impact if we influence the balance of forces against the ANC or against expropriation without compensation. In other words, to do stuff, well, in and outside South Africa, outside of parliament, and inside parliament, but with reference to what's happening outside or what people think and say outside, that would pile up the pressure on the ANC not to continue. And of course, we've done a lot of things in that regard. We met John Bolton when we were in the US, and we made no secret. We never tried to portray it as, you know, we had this meeting with him. We met him by chance. And we had like a 1 minute discussion with him. And for those who don't know, John Bolton is, I think, national security advisor in the US.
Yeah.
He reports directly to Donald Trump. We saw him. We went up to him. We met him, gave him a copy of my book, had like a 1 minute discussion, and then said goodbye. And that picture, of course, created havoc in South Africa with, who was it, Adam Abid from Wits University, claiming that this is evidence that we are Idi Amin and Adolf Hitler and, you know, all sorts of things. But the point is, in doing this, I believe we have succeeded to a very large degree to pile up international pressure on the ANC. And I've spoken with a political commentator recently who wouldn't want me to disclose his name, who said to me that he must be honest with me. He doesn't like AfriForum very much, but he has come to the conclusion that AfriForum has become the biggest role player against expropriation without compensation. And it's hard for him to say that because he doesn't agree with our approach. But we have more to show in terms of getting the ANC on the back foot and starting to backpedal on this policy. And that's particularly because of the approach that we've been taking.
What do you make of people who say, okay, fine, yes, you can take that approach. The IRR, France, has a similar view. You have to change the general view of society to change what government does and how they behave. But they'll say, yeah, but you didn't need to go to the US because what you ultimately did in the US was you somehow got this on Donald Trump's desk or in his line of sight. It was probably because Tucker Carlson started covering it, and he does watch a lot of Fox News. But bottom line is, you caused investors to suddenly be scared, and actually what you've done is you've damaged South Africa. And so that's why it's wrong.
Yeah. So I recently had I got a phone call from Chris Barron from the Sunday Times. They have this Q&A section where it's like this short Q&A in the paper. And we had it like a 20-minute conversation, and of course he didn't publish everything that we discussed, but it was very confrontational, his style, which I appreciate. And he started taking this line very much, saying, well, you should, basically arguing that we should be blamed for investor uncertainty and so forth. And I said to him at one moment, just stop and listen to yourself for a moment and explain to me how you are now, in this argument at least, different from ZANU-PF, who are blaming America for the economic situation in Zimbabwe. It's not the West's fault that there's pressure on Zimbabwe or that there are sanctions of some sort. It's the fault of the policies that are being implemented. So you mustn't shoot the messenger if the consequence is dire, because the consequences would have been dire nonetheless. And we do believe that if there are negative consequences as a result of us campaigning abroad, it would still not be as severe as the consequences if the ANC just get their way and do what they intend to do.
And there's an inherent contradiction in the views of those people that dislike you. On one hand, you are this irrelevant alt-right lobby group based on white supremacy. On the other hand, you're severely damaging the economy. Like, which one is it? You can't be like the Ku Klux Klan and have this much influence.
Yeah.
Like, do you think there's maybe a problem with the way you convey messages, perhaps? Do you have this sort of reaction against you? I personally like the way you do it. I mean, I think we're very much similar. We like these are the details, these are the facts, and fuck you, whatever. We don't really care much. But why attack you more than anyone, really? Mm. I mean, and what you say compared to some of the idiocy I see from other organizations. I mean, you are the most practically minded, rational person from a major organization. So why are you, Anas? Why are people attacking you so much? Is it your fault, do you think?
I think, well, we've been talking about that a lot to try to answer in all, you know, in all seriousness. Is there a problem with the way in which we convey the message? Which year was it? 1974, I think. Ronald Reagan gave a speech for Barry Goldwater, the famous "Time for Choosing" speech. It was very much against appeasement, which of course is very relevant to South Africa at the moment. But he made a point there about how he thinks the Cold War should be approached, and that we shouldn't try to appease the Soviets. And he said, admittedly, there's a risk in any course we take. It was sort of a note on the sideline, a comment he made. But I think it's the same with us. I mean, it would be naive of me or AfriForum to say that we have decided this is the strategy that we want to take, and we are right, and there are no risks involved. We are absolutely 100% correct, because there are some criticisms towards what we are doing that I think are valid, because it's a consequence of our strategy. The irony is that those criticisms aren't pointed out by our critics. So the stuff that they point out is stuff that aren't real, or stuff that we've never said. And they say, oh, well, you, like recently I was on Power FM and the guy just said, oh, well, you're a racist because you keep justifying apartheid. And I asked him for evidence, and I don't know if you listened to that clip. So.
Unfortunately, I did. I lost brain cells.
We did. My IQ is half now.
So just maybe that point, just for the listeners who don't know, basically what happened in that discussion, and that was just a few days ago, is the guy said to me, Thabo Mdluli, he said to me that we must acknowledge that, of course I'm paraphrasing just to shorten it a bit, but he said we must acknowledge that we're complaining now, but if they change the constitution, then expropriation without compensation would be legal, and then we don't have anything to complain about. And then I said to him, well, if that's your line of reasoning, then you shouldn't have a problem with apartheid because it was legal as well. And then he freaked out about that. And he kept saying, why are you justifying apartheid? I said to him, I'm not justifying apartheid.
He justified apartheid, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, actually he did, if you listen to what he said. So I said to him, it's like Nazism as well. There was a democratic process which led to this, and it was executed according to the laws of the time. And then I don't know if he was just ignorant or deliberate, but he somehow couldn't grasp that saying something happened according to the laws of that time does not mean that you believe that it was a good thing.
Just.
Yes.
Legality doesn't mean justice.
Yes.
That's a very simple thing. Slavery was legal. Exactly. It doesn't make it just.
Yeah.
It's a very simple thing.
So if he, I'm wondering, I should have asked him that. So do you think slavery was legal or not? Then I don't know what he would have said, because obviously it was legal. It happened according to the laws of the time.
I think when you point out, to you know, and especially in live environments, like on radio, when you people have cognitive dissonance, and then you point out the cognitive, because most of the time it's they don't realize that they have these two conflicting thoughts, and then when you point out those two conflicting thoughts and they have to meet each other in a live forum, most people don't know how to deal with that, and the way to deal with that is to say, well, I've never thought of it that way before, and if you really want to save yourself, I'm going
to
go off and think about that some more. Thanks for that.
Let me get back to you.
Or if you're really brave, admit that you were probably wrong on that point, and that hardly ever happens in modern discourse. That's what I think happened. I think he was presented with points that just didn't line up, and he didn't know how to deal with that, and unfortunately, South Africa, the word racist is the get out of jail free card, because once you call someone a racist, well, it's very difficult to defend, because what do you say? I'm not a racist. Oh, God. Then you've got to go down the road of proving you're not a racist. You're not allowed to prove you're not a racist, because if you say things like, I have black friends, then that's become that's a meme, right? So you're not allowed to say that,
that makes you more racist.
That makes you more racist somehow. And if you point out things that you've done that clearly, you know, you couldn't be right. It's like, Donald Trump is the sort of now top example of this. You know, Donald Trump's a racist, but he signs a bill the other day to give more money to Martin Luther King's like memorial or something like that, and he keeps doing stuff for black causes, and he hires people in his administration
that are
African American. It's just you cannot, once, unfortunately, we're in such an environment that I think once the word gets thrown, it's like it's a conversation ender. It doesn't matter whether it's true, whether it's not true, and what ends up happening is it'll just divide the group. So the people who listen to that probably are going, if they agree with you or see your perspective, they're going, yeah, I agree with that. He's not a racist. He just like, and the other guy, if they agree with him, they're going, oh, that other guy's a racist, because then, you know, I'll win.
But sorry, can I give you an example of that? And that's where, to get back to Ramon's question, is we do find that, I think there are very good journalists in South Africa. And I've said that many times, I think the majority are. Unfortunately, those who tend to be the most corrupt tend to be the most, they tend to be the editors. But, so here's an example in, I can't even remember the year, 2012, somewhere around there. We had this court case when the Tshwane Metro changed 27 of the street names in Pretoria. Linwood and, there was a whole list, Church Street and so forth. And we took them to court, not because of the content of the decision, but because they didn't follow the process. And one of the things that happened was, during that process, we had to file an urgent, we had to approach the court for an urgent interdict. It's a type of case where you sit through the night and you draft legal papers and you run to the court the next morning. And one of the things that was argued by our advocate was that the Tshwane Metro had argued that these names have to be changed to correct historical injustices. In our response to that, we said most of these names have nothing to do with historical injustices. It's not apartheid names, like Church Street. Yeah, for example.
Church Street, yeah.
Yeah, and then he said, he made a comment about the fact that there's a gap, a dissonance between why they say these names have to be changed and what actually happened. And then he said, for example, that he used the terms so-called injustice. In other words, the argument is that we need to correct an injustice, but there wasn't an injustice with regard to this particular street. And that was then picked up, and we are now regularly referred to as the organization that described apartheid as a so-called injustice, despite the fact that we've repeatedly said that it was an injustice. So that's the type of – it's largely a result of just poor journalism, which is very unfortunate, the situation where we are in.
Poor journalism in the sense that how we suspect journalism must be. We suspect journalism must be objective reporting on the facts. But it's good journalism in terms of being anti-anti-anti-anti-forum.
It's good activism.
There we go. That's a better word. Yeah. That's a better word. So, I mean, my question, I mean, I don't know if you answered this correctly with due respect. Do you think you can change anything that will make your message more viable for journalists? But most importantly, actually, do you actually give a shit about what News 24 says about you? Like, honestly speaking.
No, we do. I mean, it's not a good feeling when you open the newspaper and you read something horrible that you allegedly said. But the irony is, let's take News 24 as an example. They wrote this hit piece after I went to Parliament, and they said a bunch of stuff that isn't true. They said, I can't remember who wrote it. I think Pieter de Toey.
The white MPs were very cross with you, Adam. Yes. He didn't mention the black ones because, of course, they would be cross. They're black. The racism is they're so blind to their own racism. Yeah. It makes me.
So he
cringe.
Said a few things. He said that I had disdain-filled eyes sitting there, which I think is. I didn't have any disdain sitting there. I was slightly amused.
Also. I mean, I've never heard of that particular description for someone's eyes. You know, rage-filled perhaps, but disdain-filled is kind of like
English.
Yeah. And then the other thing he said was, he said that I was sitting there laughing while MPs spoke about how their families have been discriminated against, which I have never done and I would never do. And I've made a deliberate point not ever to smile even when someone tells me about how they've experienced some atrocity. I deliberately did not do that. Yes. I started laughing when the EFF lady said, you're not my brother. And then the chairperson said, no, he is your brother. And she said, no, you're my brother from another mother. And then I started laughing. And
what a discussion in Parliament.
Yes. Yeah, the extent to which I am a brother of an EFF MP. And then the other thing he said was that I offered no solutions, and then he said not a single one. Well, anyone who saw the clip saw.
Hold on, we'll get there. We'll get to what happened in Parliament.
Yeah, we'll get to Parliament particularly. But I mean, at this stage, I think, personally speaking, the more they attack you, the better it is.
That's what's happening. Yes, that's the point I wanted to make. Is as a result of that article, there were many people calling us saying, "Well, I read that and it's hogwash, and I want to support you."
Yeah, so that's just the point I want to make, which because we have the same thing. Is it's not about the more you get attacked, the better it is for you. It's the more you get attacked dishonestly, the better it is for you. Yeah. We see that on the podcast as well. We get called all types of things, and we get told about the discussions we have or had. And then we say to people, okay, but that's not true. We're like, listen to the discussion. And then what ends up happening is that person, fine, isn't going to listen or doesn't want to be swayed. But other people go, okay, I see this back and forth. Let me go check it out. They go check it out and they go, that was nonsense. Mm. And so that's the thing. I think if you were honestly attacked, I think the media might have, a better footing.
I mean, they could really damage you if you had some flaws and they accurately portrayed those flaws.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I don't understand either.
I think we have some flaws because we're not perfect. I have never felt that any interview or any debate I've done, watching it afterwards, I've never felt that it was perfect. I could always think of things I should have said better. Like someone could have said, for example, now speaking in Parliament, watching the clip again, I noticed that I stuttered quite a few times over my words. So maybe I should have spent more time reading my speech beforehand. You can talk, that's maybe a simple example, but we get a lot of people would say, well, you said this, but you never made this point. And sometimes it's a good point. Or you didn't respond to this properly because you should have rather pointed this out. And it's valid. And we can talk about the consequences of the strategy. People could say, well, ANC and EFF MPs were more angry with AfriForum when I walked out of Parliament than when I walked in. And that's true, and that's valid criticism, but unfortunately that's the negative spin-off of our strategy. I don't want them to be mad at us.
But you can't control what they feel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
If my strategy was to appease them, then I don't think, if they supported what I said, and that if I said whatever words was necessary for them to say, well, well done, and to shake hands and say thank you very much, they would have said what Adolf Hitler said after meeting Neville Chamberlain, saying, well, I met these people after the Munich Agreement. I met them and they are weak, so we can continue with what we are doing.
Right. You're not saying the MPs are Nazis.
No, I'm not saying that they are Nazis. Yeah.
It's just an example.
It's the Agri-SA approach, the appeasement approach.
No.
Okay.
You're going to get sued. Jonathan, you're going to get sued. They can sue your ass, not mine.
I think they've appeased the argument.
And I mean, they are appeasers, but we're not saying that they're like Nazi Jews.
No, man, don't be ridiculous. That's not at all what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that they've chosen the appeasement route.
Yeah.
You guys have not chosen the appeasement route. You're going to take it on. All right, so you come back from the States. As you said, a lot of people made a bigger deal of that than it actually was in some respects. I suppose, you did good work. I'm not taking that away from you. Mm. But, for example, the John Bolton meeting was by chance, as you say. Spoke to him for a minute of his day.
Mm.
He had tons of other stuff going on at the time. I think there was some North Korean stuff happening around
that
time. The Iran deal was being pulled out of. So I can't imagine that discussion you had with him was, hallmark in his life. And anyway, you come back, and obviously things are carrying on as they do in South Africa, and nothing happens for quite some time. I don't know if you got any feedback or anything
Well, we've been very engaged with the public consultation meetings.
Yeah, so you went to all these meetings. Tell us a little bit about those meetings, because there was a WhatsApp clip that got passed around, which was obviously, I mean, you can do anything with editing, but it was quite a funny clip in which there were a number of EFF supporters who sort of stood up and said the most incoherent things about either why land expropriation must happen or why, it was just kind of them like they do on Twitter. Give us the land. Give us the land.
Yeah.
So that was quite funny. But what was your experience of these?
Well, there's a lot of things that could be said. One is there was a very clear attempt to manipulate the outcome of those meetings by the chairperson. At least one or two meetings, Julius Malema was the one pointing out who should be allowed to speak. So he was pointing to the people who the microphone should be given to. I went to the first one in Springbok, in the Northern Cape, where very interesting and important thing to point out. There's a big colored community there who live on state-owned land and who are furious about the fact that they do not get title deeds. And they are at the point, they have been rioting about this. And they kept saying, well, if you are serious about land reform, why don't you want to give us title deeds? And it was sort of just shrugged away. And at the Pretoria one, it was even worse, where, well, the first thing is the EFF succeeded in hijacking those meetings. The ANC was almost nowhere. The political parties were nowhere. The two main role players there was the EFF and AfriForum. The EFF had bigger numbers. They bussed people in. And also the meetings were happening during working hours. So AfriForum sent representatives to the meetings. So at the Pretoria one, for example, before the meeting started, I don't know if they recognized me or not, but there was a whole group of EFF supporters, maybe 20 of them, wearing EFF cap, berets and T-shirts, who encircled me at one stage as I was sitting on my chair. They literally formed a circle around me and they started singing, "Kill the Boer, kill the farmer." And they were pointing at me and laughing at me. This at the full view of the panel, the parliamentary committee sitting on the stage. So that's one thing. And then during the meetings, what was, I think, the most horrible thing about those meetings was how black people who spoke against expropriation without compensation were intimidated, and I saw one who was thrown with a water bottle, and they would swear at them and call them sellouts and, you know, all that, those swear words. And I think that was the most atrocious thing. So the public consultation meetings was a farce. You need to look at other things to determine how people feel about expropriation.
Mm. Well, I think we know they're a farce because even before they were finished, the president hurriedly went onto television to tell everyone that they've decided to go ahead.
Yes. And another reason, there are many reasons why it was a farce. One was, so the chairperson, Vincent Smith, introduced the meetings or started the meetings by saying to people, well, the reason why you are here is because we have decided that we are going to do expropriation without compensation. Section 25 of the Constitution says the following. Then he reads Section 25 of the Constitution. Then he says, "You are here to say to us if the Constitution allows for expropriation without compensation, or should we change the Constitution to make this possible?" So he was asking a bunch of people who, most of which weren't lawyers, knew nothing about the law, to interpret the Constitution with the aim of telling him which road should they take to expropriate without compensation. And as we know, that's not the point of the meetings. But that's how the meetings were introduced.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, public participation has always been a farce because, well, first of all, they were hijacked. I agree with you completely. And let's go to the parliamentary hearings now, because yours was the most publicized hearing, as far as I understand, but many other people had hearings too. IR had some, the Bruderbond, I can't remember, Afrikanerbond, that one, yeah. Not the Bruderbond.
Oh my God, now you're getting sued.
I get confused.
No, they actually changed their name. It used to be the Bruderbond, and then they changed their name to Afrikanerbond.
There we go, Afrikanerbond. A lot of people did it.
Yeah, so Sakeliga.
Sakeliga did it. So, IR went there, they had a Brassey, senior counsel, Martin Brassey. His argument was purely about property rights and the importance thereof. Great submission. They treated him exactly the same way they treated you. Mm. Exactly the same way. They said, "We don't care. Our hearts are hardened. This is worthless." Basically, they just treated him as bad as they treated you. So the parliamentary hearings are a farce as well.
Yeah. Well, certainly. The way... There's a lot that could be said about our hearing and how it turned out. But, I mean, the fact that you are being threatened with a civil war by not one MP, but by two from two different parties immediately after you say, "I disagree with what you are doing," that in itself already says to us that their hearts have been hardened since before this process started. They have not decided. The purpose of these meetings aren't to – it's not to get people to convince them, should they do this or should they not? It's a window dressing process. That's all it is. Yeah.
Look, guys, we've had a government who has had basically absolute power for 24 years. And I think anyone who believes that the government cares what the sort of public in terms of the approach to parliament has to say, I've never felt these things are valid because in a coalition, I would feel they were valid because then you'd have a whole bunch of parties coming up. Potentially they want to hear different ideas. Certainly in a coalition, they want to see who they can appeal to within voting groups and blocks. And then you've got a chance of actually influencing it. But the ANC does it because it says in the law that you have to go through a public consultation process. And if you don't, it can be challenged in a court and then overturned. And so they do it as a matter of kind of need rather than because they want to or they have any great interest. So I can imagine what I find interesting is that instead of just ignoring you and saying, well, let him talk, it doesn't matter. We're going to do it anyway. I do find it interesting that the level of anger, were you surprised by that?
No.
Okay.
The worst thing that could have happened would have been if I spoke and the chairperson said, are there any questions? And then they would say, no, we don't have any questions. Thank you very much. You can go.
Worst thing for AfriForum.
Yes. Yeah, it's the worst thing that they could have done to AfriForum. In a sense, we expected that. So maybe just in terms of the strategy, we deliberately decided on a particular approach going to Parliament. And the most important thing about our approach, and I'm not saying, again, that's the point I made earlier, that it's not a perfect strategy, although I think it's the best strategy. There were other ways we could have approached it, which would have had, in my view, more ways of criticizing it. What we decided beforehand is deliberately not to engage on the debate or with the debate on the table as it is being set to us. Because the table is being set on certain premises, such as white people are criminals, white people stole the land, this is going to be good for the economy, this is something that has to be done in the interest of nation building and so forth. And we have certain underlying problems with that. So some of the criticism is, yes, well, you didn't really spend any time discussing Section 25 of the Constitution, which is true. I didn't mention it at all. But there was a reason for doing that, because we believe that the framework of the debate should be challenged instead of engaging and legitimizing the framework that has been set to us. And we expected that they would be angry. And, of course, I think I did not expect that at least two MPs would threaten with civil war. But in a sense, what they have done, and I've received a lot of messages from abroad as well, people saying they watch the clip, influential people in Washington and other places as well, who have said that they saw the clip, they thought the presentation was very good, it was factual, they thought the responses by Parliament was horrendous, and they are going to forward this to other people abroad, to influential people, to lawmakers and so forth, and journalists, to point out to them how crazy politics has become in South Africa, and particularly in Parliament. So in that sense, I think we succeeded in what we wanted to achieve.
So let's talk about what you actually said in your speech. So in your speech, you actually, to me, you exposed what this is about.
Mm.
It's not about land. It's not about helping the poor. All of this is consolidation of power within the ANC through the NDR. Mm. Can you explain, we spoke about the NDR a little bit, but if you have to have a short synopsis of what the NDR is and what the goal of it is linked to EWC.
Yeah, I think that's the most important point. And that's why we say that the structure as it is put to us should be challenged, or the framework. So the national, what I said in my presentation about the National Democratic Revolution is all taken from ANC strategy and tactics documents. And that is that the ANC believes that there must be a national democratic revolution in South Africa. And the goal of the revolution is to take South Africa down the path of socialism, eventually to create a communist utopia. And the way in which this should be done, there was a first transition in the 90s, which was that the organization should present themselves as being liberal-minded, as being in favor of free markets and so forth, to get international support and support from skeptical people in South Africa so that they can achieve state power. And then there must be a second transition in South Africa, which is to use the mechanisms of the state to further the goals of the revolution.
Because they've infiltrated the state in the first phase.
Yes.
State capture.
Yes, it is state capture. Yeah, it is exactly that. And the goal is to centralize as much power in the state as is permissible by the balance of forces. And that's why we have this balance of forces approach, so that they can achieve this. So they sincerely believe, or they claim to sincerely believe, that the state knows better than the people. And that is why it's not good for you to own property. Some, well, the EFF says this openly, and some in the ANC as well. it's not good for the people to own property. It's better for the state, because that's why we must particularly talk about white monopoly capital and not monopoly capital, because it's good if there's a monopoly. If it's a state monopoly, it's a good thing. They believe that. And that's all done in the achievement or in the pursuit of what they refer to as the National Democratic Revolution.
Right, and people like you, AfriForum, people who support property rights, are the enemies of
the revolution.
Of the revolution.
Yeah.
And when you said this in Parliament, do you think they were suddenly naked in the public square? Because I'm not sure this has ever been said in Parliament. Exposing, look guys, these are actually what your documents, we know what you're doing, we know the game you're playing, here's your game, this is what you're trying to do, and this is why it will fail. That's what your presentation did for me.
And most importantly, we got the game plan from the ANC website. It's all there. Yeah. I read it whenever I want to. It's right there. So state what they want to do.
But because it was phrased in a, you know, it wasn't what's it, a better life for all, because it wasn't phrased as that, which, if you now start thinking about it in that context, is a really dodgy phrase. But because it was phrased in the way you put it, they were suddenly, as I say, naked in the church square. I suppose that makes sense. And you said you thought they would be angry, and I suppose that understanding about exposing them for what their real motives are would make them even more angry. And perhaps that explains,
and challenging the premise of the debate.
Sure, and perhaps that explains the civil war, because truly the revolution calls for that as well. If you need to suppress any uprisings, then you do so, and you do so viciously. So that's somewhat less surprising. What really surprised me is that the largest opposition party in this country, a party based in classically liberal foundations and roots.
Yeah, supposedly.
Well, it is based in that originally, at least. Disagreed, and not just disagreed with certain parts of your presentation, didn't disagree with the tone of your presentation. No, no. They disagreed with everything you had to say.
Yeah.
As a DA voter, although that is seriously in question now after being called a racist by one of their MPs this week, and amongst other things, can you explain that at all? Because I can't.
Well, I think this is something important to point out. Is, I mean, we don't want to be a political party, and that's been sort of reaffirmed this last week as well. So you spoke about opposition politics.
Someone has to eat their hat over that, actually.
So you spoke about opposition politics, and I think that's important if you're a political party. So I can understand how or why the DA, for example, would make sort of an agreement with the EFF to make sure that Solim Simanga becomes mayor. I can understand that. I wouldn't want to do that. I'm not sure if I would be able to do that if I was a politician. But I can at least understand the strategy. But I think the problem, the opposition politics works. It works if you have backbone and if you are prepared to stand up for what you believe in and what your principles are.
And if you have opposite views, that will be very helpful.
Well, I think they do have they don't have similar views, but I think the problem with opposition politics, if you don't have a proper backbone, is there's a lot of mingling and, you know, having dinner together and, you know, meeting at the parliament bar afterwards and, you know, having some social events together. And there's almost a team spirit that's being created around this committee as well. We MPs from different parties, they disagree, but they socialize together. They sit next to each other during the hearings. And I think what happened there was, it's very interesting if you look at the responses to my presentation. At first, it was very casual. The person who was the most aggressive towards the end, the guy from the Buthelezi, not Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the other one, I can't remember his name, from the IFP, he started very casually. He said, well, I need to have some clarity on this and this. And then the one woman from the ANC spoke, and she was a bit more angry. And then the EFF spoke, and you know, they opened the floodgate. And sort of, suddenly everyone realized they should be angry. Because I think, I speculate that they felt that their little safe space has been violated. And also the members of the opposition.
And they've got to come to the defense of their friends in the EFF, almost.
That's the best conclusion I can
make. But why is Glynis Breytenbach a friend of the EFF?
Well, I'm not sure if she's a friend of the EFF, but
she acted like one.
That. Yeah.
She acted like one in that situation. I also would say I don't know that she is either. Yeah. But based on her behavior in Parliament, a woman who has a lot of respect in this country, who is a well sort of, I don't know how you would.
And worse, who has a fucking backbone.
Well, yeah, well,
she fought her, the NPA alone.
She did
and
brilliant
won.
Work with it, yeah.
So
yeah.
She's got a huge
backbone.
I was
just going to say, she's a hugely respected prosecutor.
And now her balls have been snipped. Sorry, excuse the pun. But I mean, like, now she's in Parliament. She says, she doesn't say, Ams, thank you for your presentation. She says, no, I disagree with everything you said.
Yeah. And I spoke about how corruption is a problem and how there must be restitution.
And what solutions you have, all eight of them.
Yeah, and
she agrees
I said that
none
there were
that.
Injustices and those injustices have to be corrected. And then she stands up and says, I disagree with everything.
Sure. So I don't, and please, if you're a DA, whatever you are, MP listening, we do have some MPs who listen to this show, and or you're in the party at any level and you want to come and clarify the DA's position, by all means come on the show. Because after Glynis did that, some of your MPs doubled down on what Glynis had done. And in fact, in one exchange, they were asked, so you agree with nothing Ernst said? They said, no, I agree with nothing he said. Even the part where he said he doesn't agree with expropriation without compensation, they said no, even that part. So you need to sort your shit out.
Great communications, guys.
Because it really, really doesn't reflect well on the party. But let's talk very quickly about that point that you just made around previous injustices. So people are going to say, look, it's AfriForum. AfriForum cares about white farmers. At the end of the day, they don't care about anyone else. I know there are plenty of cases for you to disprove that, but we can do that just now. What about legitimate, and do you recognize legitimate instances where land was taken away from people?
Yes.
What about those?
So we can look at, we can talk about many examples. The irony was, and I mentioned it in my presentation, that while that was happening in Parliament, we were in court on behalf of Matori Maserumule, whose land was invaded. Whose land was invaded, and the police refused to open his case. So we had to go to court on his behalf to get illegal land grabbers off his property. And that's important. I said, and that's something that's debatable, I know, and we can have a discussion about that. I made the claim, I said, the notion that, and then in quotes, white stole the land is the biggest historical fallacy of our time. And then I explained it. Now, the criticism to that can be, well, certainly white people did steal the land because there were examples of that. We can talk about dispossessions, which I then acknowledged immediately after that. I said there were dispossessions, among others, according to the 1913 Land Act and the 1950 Group Areas Act, and those were injustices and they have to be corrected. The reason why, despite that, I still believe it's a fallacy is the same reason, which I also pointed out in my speech, why it would be a fallacy to say, for example, black people are murderers. It's exactly the same logic to say, because some people, some black people have committed the crime of murder, that doesn't justify a claim black people are murderers. And it's the same thing. Some white people did really atrocious things in South Africa. And the government did atrocious things in South Africa, and we need to acknowledge that. And that's why the whole point was to say that we need to differentiate between restitution and redistribution. Where restitution is about correcting mistakes that have been made, correcting injustices, but acknowledging those injustices and being factual and having an evidence-based approach, as opposed to saying, well, you are white, therefore you're an illegitimate landowner, so we need to take it from you.
And the irony is that land restitution has gone really well. The process of land restitution has gone really well.
But it depends on how you measure it.
A bit
but
slowly,
yes.
As far as I understand.
Well, the cutoff date was 98. They settled 98% of those. 1.8 million were settled. There's 4,000 outstanding from that period of time. 93% of people took cash instead of land. And now they try to open it again. I'm not too sure what's happening these days. But land restitution at the initial stage went really, really well. And when you find out that people don't actually want the fucking land, they want money, which makes obviously perfect sense. Like, obviously perfect sense.
Can I tell you something that's really atrocious? Yeah. I went to a summit recently. It wasn't in the media publicized, but a representative from the Department of Land Reform spoke there, and we had the opportunity to ask him some questions to clarify their view. And that's, you've pointed it out already, that 93% say that they would rather want money than land. And this is a problem, according to the Department of Land Reform. That's why I say it depends on how you measure it. Obviously, it's been a big success because people who file land claims, their claims have been settled, more than 90% of them. But according to the department, this is a problem. But what is worse, I asked him to explain this to me, and he said that their view is, if, let's say, the farm is taken from a white person and given to a black person, then the injustice was corrected. But then, according to the department, a problem for them is when that black person decides to sell his land to a white person, because the white people are eager to buy the land from black people. Then the correction of the injustice has been reversed. That's the view of the Department of Land Reform. And that's the type of arguments that we are confronted with and the people that we have to debate with.
That sort of makes logical sense in some parallel universe. But it just shows like
the injustice is there's not equality of outcome.
Right. Exactly.
And if you demonize a group of people, so if white people are bad no matter what they do, because they were bad in the first place and they continued being bad. So they got wealth through illegitimate means. If you believe that and all white people somehow have money, and any money that white people have is through illegitimate means, and anything they do with that money is illegitimate, and any way they act beyond that is illegitimate, and it's always illegitimate. Doesn't matter what you do. Mm. You can't win the argument.
No, but it goes back to the original proposition of EWC, in that they don't even trust their own constituents, i.e. black people, with land. Because they don't want to give them the rights to the land. They don't want them to sell the land. They want them to be farmers with I don't know, government assistance through leases.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing...
There's been hundreds of cases, sorry to interrupt, there's been hundreds of cases where farmers have tried to assist new and upcoming black farmers, and they assist really well, except that those black farmers cannot own the land. They don't have collateral, they can't use security, they can't get capital. So obviously... The bigger play here is, it's not about the fucking land.
It's obviously about the National Democratic Revolution.
There we go.
The land is just, it's a tentacle of the National Democratic Revolution.
It's a proxy. Yeah. And if you take expropriation like compensation plus NHI, plus mining charter, plus more rigid BEE regulations, plus...
those are all the tentacles.
There we go. I mean, and that's what you're exposing Parliament so brilliantly. And that's why you get attacked so brilliantly, because people who speak the truth in terms of... What is that quote you like to say? People who speak the truth in times of lies or something.
I can't remember the...
Yeah, nothing comes offhand. But that's what we need to... But that's what the conversation should be about. And we are trying very hard. IR is trying really hard. You are trying really hard. But...
You know what's interesting? Sorry, about the reaction to my presentation. They had 20 minutes... to attack me with everything they could. None of them denied anything I said about the National Democratic Revolution. None of them denied what I said about the ANC's goal is to achieve communism or to take South Africa down the road of socialism. As a matter of fact, when I read this, you can see the reaction from the members of parliament. They just sat there listening, and the moment I started going over to there's not a hunger for land and I started quoting the statistics, that's when they really became angry. So me pointing out that we know that they are busy with the National Democratic Revolution, for me it was just saying, for them, it seemed to me like I was just saying something that they agree with.
Well, that's so obvious. It's like, of course we are. Like, why have you been saying that in public?
Yeah. And I suppose what you had said at the beginning about, in terms of the beginning of describing those public consultations, those colored folk up in the north in Springbok, those are people without title deeds. Basically, this in the end, this will make everyone be without title deeds. That's the ultimate.
If they get their way, yes.
That's the ultimate result. All right, so let's talk about. So now Parliament has happened. There's been a lot of reaction to that. Discussed a lot of the negative sort of media reporting, and I once again want to point out that negative is not a problem. It's just dishonest that is the problem. What's next in your view?
Well, firstly, just an interesting fact. So we've been told that, what was it called? This was a spectacular unraveling of AfriForum. The feedback.
Yeah, Huffington Post headlines have moved on to News 24's platform. Yeah.
So has the editors. Sorry. The white guy.
Only the white ones.
Only the white ones, though.
Yeah. So the feedback I received from our administration department is that there's been an enormous spike in people signing up at AfriForum as new members. And not only people who we call to sign up, people who contact us on their own accord, especially. Recruitments through our website, in other words, people who fill in the sign-up form, has increased by 63% after in the last week. In the last 3 days, we had 1,200 new signups in South Africa. Our average is about 3,200 a month, new members a month. We had in 3 days 1,200 new members. And what is particularly interesting is that the feedback is that it's a lot of English-speaking people and a lot of people from the Western Cape, which doesn't support the stereotype of AfriForum as being these old Boer Afrikaner guys with long beards and farmers and so forth. So there was an enormous spike. And we don't ask race on our membership form, so we don't know how many white or black members we do have. But my experience on social media and the type of phone calls and emails we get is that we have more black support now than we have ever had. We get more messages from black people who say, well, listen, thank you for what you are doing and thank you for protecting our rights. But the accusation is that we are alienating black people. And I think that can only be the result of some underlying racist stereotype.
Well, you would alienate some black people and not others. The reality is any black person who has worked hard, got where they are right now, owns a piece of property, is looking at this and going, I don't want to lose this. Why does the government want to take this away from me? And the reality is unfortunately, expropriation without compensation is going to hurt everyone. It's not it's not just going to hurt one group.
Indeed. But going back to your numbers, you've done very well in terms of new sign-ups. That is an important goal for AfriForum, I suspect, to get new members. Mm-hmm. Is it not a moral hazard being created in a sense that you talk about EWC, you get new members. And I'm not accusing you of doing this. I'm looking at myself and Jonathan as well. We are getting record numbers now since we started nailing EWC. Mm. Is there a moral hazard where we start to become maybe a little bit looser with what we say about EWC to get those higher numbers? Mm. We haven't done that at all. I'm not saying you will do that either, but there's a moral hazard. Like, we look at incentives, right?
Yes.
And the more we speak about this topic, the greater numbers we get. So let's focus on this topic all the time.
Yeah.
That's the danger.
Yeah, I think that hazard does exist. It exists, and you get more... I mean, there's stuff that I can say now. I can make up stuff and say to you, and it could be on the front page tomorrow, but it wouldn't be a good thing. So there is that risk of saying things just to be controversial, to be able to make the headlines. But I do think, looking at our members and the type of response we get, that the incentive for us is to be truthful and balanced, largely because of the perception regarding Afrikaners in this country and the history of South Africa. So there's a lot of sensitivity among our members not to be seen as racist, not to be falsely accused of, or not to be accused of racism, and that's having an element of truth, because people don't want to be, people want to have the moral high ground. And if we start telling lies or saying stuff that simply isn't true, we would feel the brunt of it. People would start resigning as members, because our members are, again, contrary to the stereotype, our members are professional people. It's high LSM people. It's lawyers and teachers and doctors and so forth. And those people would resign if we become a populist movement and if our focus was on rhetoric rather than facts, people would start resigning.
Yeah, because that's the danger with populism. And Jonathan and I have spoken. Like, we've had a record number of downloads in the past 2 months or so. Like massive. Did I say massive? Like, the hugest amount of downloads ever.
Huge!
And we have spoken to you. We've spoken to Franz Crenier about EWC. Gareth van Onselen last week to a lesser degree. But We spoke, do we keep going on about this? Because there's a lot to talk about in EWC and the NDR. There's like a lot to talk about.
And it's an existential crisis. If this happens, there is a lot to lose for everyone.
Yeah.
So we think, should we like carry on with it, or should we try to diversify our guests a bit to talk about other topics, knowing that they won't be as popular as what we're doing now? It's a moral hazard. And, we've spoken about it, and I've set some fears about becoming a bit populist.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys have become an alternative voice. It's strange to have to use the word alternative, but And people are realizing it more and more, that if you read mainstream media, a lot of it, you find that, and then you compare that to what actually happened, like you watch the video clip of something and then you see how it's reported, you see that there's a massive gap. And then people find that what they find on at a place like Renegade Report is much more factual. It has a lot more depth. There's an understanding of what's happening in South Africa in terms of, for example, the National Democratic Revolution, which some in the media tend to think it's some big conspiracy theory, despite the fact that it's written in the ANC's own documents.
I also think, look, that word populist is getting thrown around a hell of a lot lately in the last year and a half. And I don't think people understand what it means. They like using the word to describe things that are popular, which they disagree with. And that isn't what it is at all. And it's interesting because the things that are being described as populist, in my opinion, certainly aren't populist. And the people describing those things as populist, in my opinion, are actually the populists by definition.
And the immigration is like a big thing. Most people don't want like open border immigration. But if Donald Trump says, I'm not for open border immigration, that's a populist position. No, it's not at all.
Yeah. There's a lot of twisting of words and a lot of, just wordplay being thrown around, accusations. This week, I don't know how many times we were called alt-right. Yeah. That sort of slur is getting really old. I don't know how it's still has any effect.
No one still knows what it means.
Well, that's the other point. I mean, there's one person who still identifies as alt-right. Is Richard Spencer, I think, still identifies as it, and pretty much the 20 people who follow him around America. But anyway, where do you think, despite the successes for AfriForum from presenting and the reaction that caused those successes, do you think we're having any success in terms of fixing South Africa? Because the reality is, you know, that before she blocked me on Twitter, I had an interesting discussion with Ferial Heffergy, which was actually a very reasonable discussion. I'd love to have her on the show because this was quite a nice chat we had, which was, we both want what's best for South Africa. We just see different ways to get there. And which is a fair comment. And then what we need to do is hash it out about the different ways and whether one way is better or another. What do you think is happening in terms of the better way for South Africa to go?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important questions. And I think that's the underlying friction that we have the underlying issue that some commentators and people in the media have with AfriForum is, we all want South Africa to be a better place. But we seem to differ on what the problem is. And I think we discussed it a little bit the previous time I was on, is that we believe that there are certain fundamental problems with the way the system is put together. But we have this grand narrative in South Africa that South Africa was evil, everything was evil, and now we were in hell and now we're in heaven, post-1994. And we have the best constitution in the world, and we have a ruling party who's the party of Nelson Mandela and who's a party of freedom and a saintly party, and they might have made some mistakes, they might have stolen some money along the lines, but inherently they are good. And I think there's a fundamental disagreement on that. So I do think we can, to a large extent, it goes back to the constitution, and the biggest problem with the constitution is, the biggest question about the constitution is, how is it interpreted? So I can say to you that I think we have an incredible constitution based on my interpretation of the text. But then Ronald Lamola or whoever from the ANC would also say we have an incredible constitution, the best in the world, because they interpret it in a completely different way. They read the constitution and they see radical economic transformation has to be executed.
Or free housing.
Yeah, free housing and stuff like that.
Or a right to housing, put it that way.
Yes. So I think that's the underlying problem, is I think that I'm not against the notion of democracy itself, but I think South Africa is more a majoritarianist country than a democracy, because democracy is about, the test if a democracy is a functioning democracy is whether minority rights are protected and whether the rule of law is being upheld. And that's, I think, what was brilliant about Saakhe Lighas' presentation in Parliament, is they made the point that there are certain underlying values that cannot be detached from the notion of constitutionalism. So you can change the constitution, but a constitution still needs to adhere to the values or the principles of constitutionalism to be a legitimate constitution. And the moment when you take property rights away, for example, you can have a voting process to do that. And you can say, well, we've changed the constitution according to the laws that require us to do it. But when you start taking away property rights or freedom of speech and so forth, then you start chipping away at the principles of constitutionalism. And you can say, well, it was democratically done. It wasn't. It was done according to majoritarianism, which is different. And I think that's an underlying disagreement that we have.
Yeah, I think a lot of people conflict the spirit with the letter. So the spirit of constitutionalism is limited government, full rights to citizens, voting, that sort of stuff. The letter of the law is how do you pass a law. But passing a law does not make it legitimate, does not make it constitutional. You can tick all the boxes. We got public participation, there's a white paper, a green paper, there's a bill, and the Constitutional Court agrees with the legislation once it's enacted. All those processes can still be constitutionally illegitimate.
Mm. Well, what you just said would have been interpreted by Power FM as a justification of apartheid, according to this latest view. But I think that's the point, is doing something according to a particular process, although there's a problem with the process, there are a lot of problems, but even if the process is valid, that does not mean that it's legitimate necessarily. Absolutely. And again, the best example is Nazism. And again, it's not to say that the ANC are a bunch of Nazis, but it's a perfect example of something that's being done according to at least some form of democracy or some form of majoritarianism. And it's an illegitimate system the way it turns out to be at the end of the day.
It's populism.
Yeah.
And they call you populist.
Right. So do you want to take the Patreon questions as a separate podcast and let our Patreons have the access to that individually?
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's do that. So we're gonna wrap this up for the moment. We will release the Patreon stuff a little bit later on, but we'll give the Patrons first access.
Have we finished our conversation?
Well, you want to carry on?
Yeah.
With more.
Are you in a rush?
I have at least one more thing.
That's absolutely not a problem. Let's carry it on in the Patreon side of things. But let Ernst finish his point, and then we'll continue it on there.
Yeah. Now, there was a question you asked that I didn't fully answer, and it was about what now? What lies ahead?
Yes.
So I've discussed what our strategy is, so we would continue with the strategy. I don't think I've seen today news reports where the ANC claims that the majority of people who participated in the process were in favor of a constitutional amendment, which is false. We do know that the vast majority of the written submissions were against expropriation without compensation. We submitted about half of the written submissions. We know the IRR submitted up to almost 100,000. And so there were three ways in which this process was followed. There was written submissions, public hearings, and parliamentary submissions. Public hearings, yes, the majority of people supported expropriation without compensation, although the process was flawed because of, even if only for the way the question was framed.
But how many people actually spoke at the public hearings?
I think they said 2,000 or something, yeah.
Yeah, so
it was around there.
In terms of numbers, it's irrelevant.
As opposed to hundreds of thousands of written submissions.
Yes. Yeah, 800,000 as far as I remember.
Yeah. And then in Parliament, 84%, if I have the number right, of the parliamentary presentations were against the change. So the ANC, if they push this, then we can use the courts to force them to release the information to say, well, if you really say the majority supported this, we want to see every written submission. So we are prepared to do that. And we will continue with our campaign in South Africa and abroad. We will organize protest marches if we need to. We will continue speaking to international role players. We have seen the biggest concessions that the ANC has made in terms of backpedaling on this, on how they frame it at least, has always been in response to a big pressure that's being put on them from abroad. Like when Peter Dutton made those comments from Australia, Cyril Ramaphosa said, no, 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 we're not going to be that bad when we do this. The same with the Tucker Carlson interview when we went to the US. The same with the tweet from Donald Trump. Now, compare that. Compare the ANC's reaction to that, which is every time, no, 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 whoa, whoa, it's not that going to be that bad, to their reaction during these appeasement-type discussions that they have with role players. We've seen that our strategy works. And if anything happens, if it teaches us anything, it's that we need to up the ante, that we need to have more international campaigns. We need to go back to Washington. We need to go to Europe. We need to go to other countries. We need to lobby with international communities, with governments abroad and so forth. And there's a lot that we still can do and that we certainly would do.
Awesome. So if you want to continue listening to Ernst, and want to continue to listen to our discussion, I'm sure we'll carry on for another half an hour or so. Mm. We've got a whole bunch of questions from some of our patrons. Then please do consider a donation, any donation on Patreon. We really would appreciate it.
Just for reference, our Patreon, literally $1 a month. If I've seen the list of numbers, there's dozens of thousands of you. If 5% give $1, we'll be able to get video, we'll be able to get editing, we'll be able to get so much, the podcast will get so much better.
Unfortunately, our numbers are massive, but have you said massive before?
Huge, huge.
Advertisers are terrified. They are terrified. This is a country where if you say anything untowards, you are destroyed for it, or you have people right. jumping up and down.
But I think deep down, we actually do not want to be advertiser friendly. We don't want the show to be dictated by.
No dictation, and maybe that's why they're staying away. But either way, they are staying away, so those of you who dislike us, you'll be happy to know.
And so we're just using the AfriForum model of having people with skin in the game. No, really, it's legitimate. Mm-hmm. People with skin in the game. Paying us, giving us a little contribution each month, be it 10 rand or be it 1,000 rand. No one pays 1,000 rand, I wish. But every month, because they like what we do, they like the message we're trying to
They
want to continue supporting us, and they want to ensure that other people hear what we say because it's very important to them. And so even if you have 10 rand a month, we will gladly accept that.
It's our traffic light pitch. As well, as you know, you can always find us on Twitter at Renegade_Report, on Facebook, both the page and the group, Ramon at Roman Kabanak, myself at Jonathan_Witt, Ernst on Twitter.
Yes,
at Ernst Roots. There you go. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks so much for listening. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.